May it please the court. As you've noticed, my name is Jill Golding. I'm here representing the appellant, Brittany Tovar. And with permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Brittany Tovar is the mother of a teen son who is transgender. And by that, I mean I'm referring to a medically diagnosable condition. It means, in essence, that her son's gender identity or his sense of himself as being a boy or a girl is different from the gender that he was assigned at birth. So specifically, that means that he identifies as a boy. He understands himself to be in every way a boy, even though certain aspects of his biology, and I'm referring here, and I probably won't refer to genitals again, but I'm referring to his genitals at birth, those would be typical for a girl. So that's what we mean by him being transgender. In 2015, Brittany Tovar worked for Essentia, and she had an employer-provided health care plan. That health care plan covered her and her son as her beneficiary. The plan had an exclusion. This was written right into it. It was express language, and it said, we will exclude any services, and they mean that word broadly, technically it says any services or surgery, any medical care for gender reassignment. And it specifies, regardless of whether it's medically necessary. Because the plan had that exclusion, in 2015, Brittany Tovar's son, who, as I said, was medically diagnosed as being transgender, had medications prescribed by his doctor that were very important. They were important to his health. And he wasn't able to obtain those medications. Some medications he wasn't able to obtain. They were considered excluded under this provision because they related to him being transgender. And his mother had to pay out of pocket. But some he didn't get at all.
Ms. Tovar's son was insured under the policy. That's your position, is that right?
He was a beneficiary under her benefits as an employee. We don't believe that he has an independent right to bring a suit under Title VII. He's not covered by Title VII, but she is.
You said that she and her son were covered by the policy. You're not saying that one way or another he was an insured. It's only through her that he gets his insurance.
I'm not sure I'm understanding Your Honor's question, since I'm not distinguishing the notion of being covered by in the sense of she can be covered as an employee because she accepts this coverage. He can be covered because he's her beneficiary.
Through her response.
Exactly. He didn't work for Essentia. He was a kid.
Do the documents, though, show him as an insured? You know how normally health insurance plans, they list the principal person and they list insureds?
I believe it would, Your Honors.
Is that the record? I'm not asking.
I don't believe it is. This is a motion to dismiss case. What we have is the complaint, and I would have to look at the complaint to see if we phrased it that way.
Proceed.
Well, so if you have a parent and a parent's siblings named in the policy, then the siblings would be insured, would be an insured under the policy. I'm troubled here because of whether your client has standing to assert this particular claim.
I think that's exactly the issue that Essentia brings forward, and we say yes, absolutely, she does have standing.
She didn't bring it as parent and next friend of her child, which ordinarily is she could represent the child under those circumstances.
I think it's a critical point that she didn't need to do that, Your Honor. She is asserting her own claim as an employee under Title VII and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. She is alleging that her terms and conditions and privileges of employment, her compensation, to be specific, was impacted by this reduction in benefits. And there are a number of cases that in which courts recognize that benefits are part of terms, conditions, and privileges of employment. Newport News is probably the best known of those cases. That's a Supreme Court case from 1983. But in all of those cases, for instance, Newport News involves spouses, and the court didn't have any expectation that the male plaintiffs, the employees bringing that case, would bring them on behalf of their spouse. They brought them for themselves.
It was 1983, though, and the Supreme Court says the reason we think it violates Title VII is because when they talk about the other person's spouse, it tells, when they talk about the spouse's gender, it tells the other gender.
Right. We refer to that.
Does that hurt you in the end? Because it has to reflect back. It's kind of a bounce back principle that the Supreme Court's using in Newport News. In the end, doesn't that hurt you?
No, Your Honor. We use the word reciprocal characteristic. That might sound more abstract than bounce back. We'll use that going forward.
No, it
means the same thing, though.
Reciprocal's higher language. Go ahead.
Fancier. But we're talking about the same thing. And absolutely, that's the way Newport News was described. As we understand it, that was a good example of the Supreme Court exercising a beautiful degree of judicial minimalism. I mean, in 1983, that was absolutely the narrowest ground to explain why Newport News came out the way it did. But there are plenty of other cases since then, and we point to Thompson as another recent Supreme Court case recognizing another type of associational discrimination that really gives the broader rule. And I think, I mean, this court really does face a choice. Either you can look back at Newport News and say, we think Newport News is no longer good law. It's perfectly fine to discriminate against beneficiaries. Or I think the more natural course, the more logical course is to say there are other bases on which Newport News could be decided. And in fact, we find them in cases like Thompson. And we cited a number of those in our brief. I was starting to tell the story here, and I have to admit that was partly to lead you all on a distraction. It's important to me as a human being, but I do want to emphasize that there's actually nothing about the case before the court that has anything to do with the fact that our son is transgender. Both of these defendants are asking for a broad sort of license to discriminate that would apply for all protected categories. What they're asking for would allow discrimination against blacks or Jews or women or, you know, it doesn't matter. It applies across the board.
So discrimination is prohibited.
We believe ultimately that it is, and that is because the statute forbids discrimination because of sex, and actually...
It
depends on which dependent. So for Essentia, it's under Title VII and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And for Health Partners, it's Section 1557. But they're all part of this discrimination law landscape that talks about discrimination because of sex. And we believe that that question's actually not before the court yet because the defendants haven't argued it. And that's actually the point I was getting to. That's why the fact that he's transgender isn't really relevant. They're asking for much broader exemptions to discrimination law that would let them off the hook here. They're not saying this isn't discrimination because of sex. I think ultimately, and we briefed this because we thought it would be of interest to the court, it's pretty clear that those are very plausible claims. One example, a really critical case on this is Hunter, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, Judge Beam. But Hunter, just to give a little bit of context, was a case in which this court found against a transgender plaintiff. But the reason was really clearly a narrow ground. It was a case similar to a pregnancy discrimination case where the employer didn't know the person was pregnant, or a disability case where they had no idea they were disabled. You're never going to win a case like that as a plaintiff. But what the court said in Hunter, they said, you know, this is generally actionable, and they actually cited to Price Waterhouse as an example, which is part of the line of cases that support all sorts of circuits finding that trans discrimination is actionable as a form of discrimination because of sex. So we think under cases like Hunter, under the statute language itself for the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and under the proper interpretation of 1557, ultimately, this exclusion is going to be found discriminatory. But the question before this court for Essentia is it okay to discriminate against beneficiaries on any protected ground whatsoever simply because they're beneficiaries? I mean, that would let an employer say, we don't cover black dependents. We don't cover women dependents. We don't like Jews. Fine, we have to provide coverage for Jewish employees, but we're going to draw the line at dependents. We don't cover them. It sounds crazy, but we laid out some maybe less crazy examples in our briefing, and this case itself is an example. If that's the rule, it would really upend anti-discrimination law across the board. There's no rationale for having that kind of broad exemption. The line that we draw in terms of how associational discrimination is understood is much more consistent with the statute and the case law and logic.
This is a disc- discrimination on the basis of sex. Is that what you're contending here?
Ultimately, this case will be about that, but right now it's about, for Essentia, the question, is it okay to discriminate on any otherwise completely barred ground simply because it's the beneficiary and not the employee? And they kind of get there in two steps, and I think the lower court, may reach the wrong conclusion on both parts.
This isn't, though, discrimination on the basis of sex, then the case would be over now, wouldn't it?
That would be true. I think that's inconsistent with Hunter for Title VII. I think it's inconsistent with the statutory, express statutory language of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which was also recognized in Hunter. It would be inconsistent with the decisions of a lot of the other circuits. It would be inconsistent for 1557 with the tendency to align Title IX and Title VII and decisions, for instance, in the Fourth Circuit that did find that Title IX reaches transgender discrimination.
The Supreme Court has sent that back to the Fourth Circuit yesterday, didn't
they? They did, and we apologize that happened so quickly and so close to today. We none of us were in a position to officially notify the court. We don't see that as relevant, Your Honor, because this court has the capacity to decide, just as it already decided in Hunter. It can simply follow Hunter, and that's the appropriate thing to do at this point.
Well, it must have been a question in the Supreme Court's mind for them to have granted cert to begin with, and now with the changing around of the regulations or the abrogation of the regulations, they have decided that maybe they need to let it go back to the Fourth Circuit and let them wrestle with it for a while. And why shouldn't we let the Fourth Circuit wrestle with it for a while then until?
I think maybe those are two different questions, Your Honor, and I think in both cases the answer we would give is this court is empowered and should go ahead and decide the issues presented to it here by Essentia and Health Partners. I think the Supreme Court sending Gigi back to the Fourth Circuit is really another example of sort of appropriate judicial minimalism. The thing that brought that case to the Supreme Court was actually not a regulation, it was a guidance. And the Trump administration has pulled that guidance. That still leaves a regulation, but more importantly, it still leaves a statute itself. And there are courts that have found Title IX on its terms as a statute reaches, in the same way that Hunter decided that for Title VII. But it's appropriate for the Supreme Court, since it was brought to them about the guidance and then the guidance disappeared, to say, okay, we admit it's going to be back here in a couple years, but let's let the Fourth Circuit talk about the statute itself. And in the same way, I think the Supreme Court, if we could ask them, would say, let's let the Eighth Circuit decide.
Any rebuttal?
Yes, I will reserve the remainder of my time, Your Honors. Thank you so much.
And you have 7.5 minutes?
Yes, sir. Okay. I've got 7.5 minutes. My name is David Wilk. May it please the court. I represent Health Partners and Health Partners Administrators, Inc. And my colleague, who represents Essentia, will have the other 7.5 minutes. Now, this case really is not about transgender health rights. We may not agree with everything Ms. Tovar's counsel has said, but Judge Kyle was able to dispose of this case without ever getting to that issue because of the standing issue that Judge Beam has already highlighted for us to be thinking about as we're up here.
Well, go slowly with me on 1557.
Okay.
Because it says an individual, that means any person in the world, cannot be denied the benefits of any health program on any ground that's in Title VII or Title IX.
Or Title IX. Right? That's exactly what it says. And it says that those statutes shall apply within 1557 as well.
So, do you agree that the son can bring a lawsuit in this case? They're an individual. They were denied the benefits.
If the son brought a case against a covered entity, we also need to have a covered entity.
One of the two of you is a covered entity, aren't you?
Well, a covered entity under the Affordable Care Act is an entity that it's not the employer. A little bit different. We have the 1557 is part of the Affordable Care Act, Judge.
I understand that.
And you need
go slowly with me.
Yes, sir.
It's worded very broadly. I didn't see any covered entity talk in here.
That's what the Affordable Care Act applies to.
Yeah, but I'm reading the section of law.
Okay. All right.
It doesn't mention covered entities in that section 1557, right? Tell me if I don't get it, it's in there.
Understood. And I believe that either according to the complaint, either HP or HPAI, according to the plaintiff, is a covered entity. And I believe Judge Kyle assumed that for purposes of this decision. And we're not arguing about covered entity today because it would get us into the weeds about discovery. But what we do pull in to 1557 is all of the law about Title IX. Congress didn't create a new cause of action out of whole cloth. It said there's a whole body of law out here for Title IX, Title VII, and other provisions. Let's set aside for the moment the fact that the son didn't sue. Let's set aside for the fact the moment that the mother sued. She's not transgender. She was never allegedly discriminated against. And even set aside the fact that Judge Kyle pointed all of that out in his summary or in his motion to dismiss order, and the plaintiff amended after that, knowing full well that she didn't have standing and did nothing to correct that. Set all of that aside. Let's look at 1557, Your Honor, because it does import Title IX, but it imports all of it. It imports the requirement that there be a deliberately indifferent act of discrimination, known discrimination, within the control of the defendant. Now, remember, I represent HPAI. We are, at the risk of adding another acronym, a TPA. We're a third-party administrator. This is not within our control, Your Honor. Essentia issued a plan. Essentia is the plan sponsor. The plan wasn't sued under 1557. The plan sponsor wasn't sued under 1557. The TPA was sued under 1557. The plan itself makes clear we, that is HPAI, don't control the plan. We can't change the plan. So we have a requirement about control. Now, what you're going to hear when I sit down is, well, they're trying to say they are exempt from 1557. They are trying to have a pass on discrimination. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is Congress was very clear that by importing Title IX in, you are responsible for discrimination, but it has to be yours, discrimination you control. Let's think about an example. We know Judge Kyle looked at this 2016 plan. This exclusion was removed at the next first available chance. It could be removed. It was removed. Now, assume for the moment that a TPA, not Health Partners, HPAI certainly, but a TPA said, you know what, I don't care that that exclusion's been removed. I'm not approving this care anyway. That would be something within the TPA's control to not process the claim. If the TPA processed the claim and the person went to the pharmacy and needed the medication, the testosterone hormone, and the pharmacy said, you know what, we're not going to process that. That's something within their control. So under 1557, the only way it can work is for you to look at, as Title IX says, what is controlled by the entity that's being sued. And if the claim is about the plan and the terms of the plan, you need to look at the plan sponsor. You need to look at the plan itself. You don't look at the TPA that has a fiduciary duty under ERISA to follow the plan by its terms.
1557 is passive, and you say after the shall not be excluded, you say it means by whoever controls the plan, that that's what it really means.
It means by who's ever engaging in the discrimination that you're alleging, because that's what Title IX has always required. Title IX talks about discrimination, known acts of discrimination under its control. That's Title IX law. So when Congress imported Title IX into 1557, it had to mean that.
But it didn't import all of Title IX. It imported grounds from Title IX. Ground is the term Congress picked. They were looking at the reasons, not the who.
Well, it talks about mechanism, the next sentence. The last sentence of that provision talks about the mechanisms of such acts shall apply. The mechanisms of Title IX are the enforcement mechanism.
Is that in 557A or is that a separate subsection of A?
It's in the second subsection under B.
So it's 557B where
yes,
that
sir.
Is?
Okay, yes,
go ahead.
Sir.
Sure, go ahead.
Be sure I've got that. I believe I've got it correct. It's in 557, Your Honor.
Yeah, I just have A. Go ahead. That's the reason
fine.
I asked the question.
That's fine. Judges, I have a minute, and I want to return to where I was going to start. which I'm happy to do, and it has to do, and just to highlight the standing issue. The standing issue is really the narrow, we've heard about narrow grounds to decide cases. This is the narrow grounds on which Judge Kyle decided the case. The facts, the allegations were never changed or amended or altered to respond in any way to what Judge Kyle had found, because Judge Kyle ultimately was correct. The son has never sued. The son has never brought a cause of action. The mom is not bringing a claim on behalf of the son. She's bringing it on behalf of herself, her own claim, when she was not denied any coverage at all, when she's not transgender. And so the issue is standing. It's redressability by a TPA for a claim that should have been brought, if at all, against the plan itself or against the plan sponsor, the employer. Your Honors, I'm sorry, sir.
If he had a right, she could have brought the case if he were disabled or a minor or something on his behalf, but that didn't happen.
May I answer?
Proceed.
Thank you. She could have brought that claim. She was notified about the deficiency by His Honor Judge Kyle. She could have brought the claim, and we would at least not have the standing issue today. We would have certainly the 1557 issue we've gone through.
I was dealing with this.
All right. Judge, thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Wilk.
Thank you.
Ms. Edison Smith?
May it please the court.
See.
My name is Lisa Edison Smith, and I represent the appellee in this case, Essentia Health, who is also the employer of Brittany Tovar. Before I begin and launch into my presentation, I'd like to beg the court's indulgence. I am hard of hearing. I have been provided an assistive device, and it's not working completely correctly for me. So I am having a little trouble hearing Judge Beam, but I will do the very best that I can.
You're lucky.
Perhaps that's the case, Your Honor. Thank you. As Mr. Wilk pointed out, this is not a case in which Ms. Tovar has brought a claim under a representative capacity for her son, or her son is a named party in the case. The claim against my client is not a claim under Section 1557. Rather, the claims are employment law claims brought under Title VII of the Human Rights Act and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And Ms. Tovar claims by virtue of the fact that the exclusion in the policy in 2015 applied to her transgender son, that she has a discrimination claim against her employer in employment. Even though she admittedly is not transgender, she's not in a protected category. As Judge Kyle pointed out, she doesn't allege that she was given a different plan of benefits than any other employee based on any protected category, or that she herself was denied any benefit. So based on that, the question before the court, as Mr. Wilk has pointed out in his context, but also in the Title VII and Minnesota Human Rights Act context, is does this plaintiff, this appellant, have standing to bring this issue before this court when, according to the what we believe well-reasoned opinion of Judge Kyle, she suffered no injury in fact that wasn't derivative exclusively of the denial of benefits to her son. And as such, she was not within the zone of interest that is required to, in order to imbue statutory standing on her. So the issue is narrow in this case. Although Ms. Galding has talked about very broad issues of an employer who may discriminate by denying coverage for based on race or based on disability or based on religion, that's not the issue that's presented to this court. The issue that's presented to this court is merely, can she assert this as an injury in employment? Title VII was intended, the zone of interest protected under Title VII is to protect employees in their employment. It doesn't say anything about protecting them based on beneficiaries and in insurance policies. And the Minnesota Human Rights Act, in fact, the only provision in the Minnesota Human Rights Act referring to benefits at all refers to the necessity of covering pregnancy. And in this case, Judge Kyle answered that with a resounding no.
Well, if this is a benefit of her employment, certainly she would have standing to bring a cause of action, right?
Your Honor, she would have standing to raise a cause of action if she, in fact, were denied a benefit of employment because of sex. And the cases that the plaintiff, Ms. Tovar, has asserted, the Newport News case, for example, they don't allow derivative standing such that she can raise the right of her son, the dependent beneficiary under the claim. Newport News came back, as Judge Benton pointed out, Newport News turned on the fact not that there was a denial of coverage to the spouse, but rather that it was based on the gender of the employee in his employment.
Well, if some way or another the policy can be read that he is an insured, then he could sue you, right?
He could possibly sue, as the first issue brought up is Section 1557 and other avenues of recourse, and the question of whether Ms. Tovar's son himself could have standing to sue. However, the issue is, what's the zone of interest under Title VII? And has she, in fact, been injured under Title VII? And all of the case law that's been cited, all of the case law cited by either party, turns on the fact that the injury must be a separate and distinct injury that injures the plaintiff in his or her employment. And in this case, that just doesn't exist. The injury that Ms. Tovar is asserting, which was the lack of benefits available to her son, as Judge Kyle pointed out, the damages that she contends, which are, she alleges emotional distress and some financial out-of-pocket expenses, those are the type of injuries that are wholly derivative of the injury to her son. And that's precisely the type of standing argument that's been rejected. It was rejected in the Glass versus Hillsborough School District case. It was rejected in the Niemeyer case. It was rejected in the Mysak case. In the Mysak case, briefly, the employee attempted to raise a claim of discrimination based on disability. The employee himself was not disabled. However, he had a disabled spouse and a son. And the policy of insurance excluded coverage for hearing aids and certain coverage for speech language. In that case, the court concluded that the employee did not have standing because he did not have any injury that was not wholly derivative or just the effects of the injury to his dependents. Therefore, since it wasn't discrimination in employment, since it wasn't discrimination based on his protected category, it was not within the zone of interest, contemplated by the statute. Your Honor, the disturbing part of this is the breadth of the scope of standing that is proposed by plaintiffs is huge. On page 27 of the reply brief, plaintiff argues that the laws don't require that employees actually suffer a loss in benefits or compensation. Employees, may I conclude, Your Honor?
Please do.
Employees suffer actionable harm, according to the plaintiffs, and qualify as aggrieved persons any time an employer adopts a discriminatory plan with the potential to impact their terms, conditions, and privileges of employment.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Galding?
Thank you, Your Honors. I have a number of points on both claims, and my overarching point is it's really important not to mix these two issues together. They've made completely separate arguments, although they both use the word standing. They're completely different issues brought by both of them. And respectfully, some of the points that were made regarding 1557 I think are inaccurate. The issue under 1557 has nothing to do with the fact that this is her son and not her. The issue has to do with whether TPAs can ever be liable under Section 1557. That was the issue that Judge Kyle ruled on. We believe he ruled incorrectly, but he never ruled that there was an issue because the son didn't sue. To be clear, the son can sue under 1557. We chose not to bring that claim. We thought it was redundant with his mother's. We would take the position that he absolutely cannot sue under Title VII. Title VII is about employee rights. His mother is the employee. She's the one who's been very directly harmed. And I would point out regarding that issue, counsel for Essentia said that we are asking for a crazily broad scope. Quite the opposite. If you look at the list of people who are allowed to be your beneficiaries, it's very narrow. You can't bring anyone off the street and have them be your beneficiary. We know that, right? So in saying that beneficiaries are part of the associational discrimination umbrella, that's a very narrow decision. And the court in Thompson actually talks about concerns about slippery slope and says, what happened in Thompson, which was associational discrimination, retaliation where it was the fiancé who engaged in the protected activity, absolutely covered. This beneficiary issue is even narrower. It's an easier case than Thompson. So that's what I would say regarding Essentia. She's absolutely been harmed, and there's nothing about the rule we're proposing that's in any way broad. Regarding 1557, Gebser doesn't apply. That's about sexual harassment. This is about direct express discrimination. We cited to guidelines for Title IX. When it's the school saying we only teach boys math, Gebser doesn't apply. You don't need notice of your own discriminatory policy. And the ultimate issue really is this question of whether issues like those addressed in Title VII with staffing agencies, which is the closest analogy here, they don't cite any Title IX cases that go against this really long-standing doctrine of how staffing agencies should be treated. The logic of the staffing agency rule absolutely applies, and we believe that's the right way to interpret 1557 as a question of first impression.
Ms. Galding, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument. The case of Tovar 16-3186 is submitted for decision. That concludes our calendar.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so the court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Thank you, everyone.